This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, the story of a midlife sabbatical and spiritual quest. Mary Rose O'Reilly is our guest. O'Reilly worked tending sheep in an agricultural barn for a year. O'Reilly is the author of a collection of essays about the experience. The title, The Barn at the End of the World, The Apprenticeship of a Quaker Buddhist Shepherd. O'Reilly was raised a Catholic. Today she is a Quaker and a student of Buddhism. Mary Rose O'Reilly teaches at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota. In addition to The Barn at the End of the World, she is the author of Peaceable Classroom and Radical Presence. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments this afternoon. Join us with a telephone call. Our number in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Mary Rose O'Reilly, good afternoon. Welcome.
Hello, Celeste. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's a pleasure to talk with you. I am enjoying your book so much.
I'm glad.
How did you make the choice to become a Quaker?
Oh, my goodness. A lot of that happened a long time ago, back in the Vietnam days, when I was a graduate student and helping students to formulate conscientious objection status, because I was very much a kind of Catholic worker, Catholic and very involved in nonviolent kinds of witness. And it was almost impossible for a student, for a young person, to formulate that within Catholicism. So I began to investigate Quakerism as a peace church, just so that I could, you know, be within that and raise my children within that peace testimony.
Mm.
It's completely possible, of course, now to do that as a Catholic, but it wasn't 25 years ago.
Yeah.
It wasn't so easy, at least.
As a very young woman, you joined a Catholic religious community.
I did.
What was that experience like?
I was in a novitiate for 2 years. Well, you know, it was extraordinarily life-changing. It anchored me in a reality that I've really never left, and was profoundly formative in just the strangest kind of ways, you know, from learning how to cook and learning how to sew, which I still do and still love to do, you know, to really understanding how important silence is in your life.
Mm.
And order and retreat and extremely rowdy jokes. Because a lot of that goes on in a novitiate, let me tell you.
Your interest in Buddhism, it began in the convent when you were a novitiate. Would you tell us, please, about Sister Michael Ann?
Well, Sister Michael Ann was in the next cubicle with the little curtains around her bed. And she was our novice superintendent when we were postulants. It's very hard, you know, when you're 18 years old, which I was, to figure out what you're supposed to be doing as a contemplative. I had a lot of trouble figuring out what we were supposed to do when we closed our eyes and sat still. And Sister Michael Ann was doing Buddhist meditation in a Christian tradition, which is entirely possible. You know, she would sit on her bed, and I would just watch these curtains stop rustling and be very interested. And she gave me books, and I began to try to do that a very long time ago.
Hmm. So Catholicism, Quakerism, Buddhism, what do they have in common?
Well, I've come to understand in my religious wanderings and bleatings, a sheep is a very good metaphor for my religious journey, that the core of all of these, I think of all the great religious traditions, is contemplation and is an intuitive sinking down in silence and quiet. And all of those religions have that as their central point of reference, although, you know, by decade and decade, we lose and gain that contemplative center. But I think that that's at the heart, which is why I never think of myself as a lapsed Catholic. You know, I think of myself as a person who dearly loves the church and, you know, has that at the root of things.
Mm-hmm.
But that these other, it took me a long time to figure out that I was on the same journey when I thought I would be sort of changing brand names and realizing that I was, you know, coming home to the same place.
Mm. So in midlife, you found yourself seeking out a job tending sheep in an agricultural barn. So what's the connection between that job and spirituality?
Well, I found myself is exactly a good way to put it, because I think I've gotten in the habit, Celeste, of listening to a kind of pull that I feel at my gut. And I suspect that a lot of people who are listening might have that same experience, you know, a sense of calling. And you know, we think of these vocations as, you know, gigantic, you know, important ideas. But in reality, they tend to be very gentle and very odd often. You know, I want to be in a barn. I would like to turn and live with animals, as Walt Whitman wrote that wonderful poem about. It was just a strong pull and so strange that I denied it for years.
Mm.
And then one day in just, you know, some quiet place, I thought, no, I really want to be with animals. I really want to understand. I want to return to a feeling that I had as a child of being very peaceful in a barn full of breathing animals.
This is how you put it in the book in one of the essays. You found yourself wandering away as children do, sometimes alone, sometimes in silence.
That's right. That's right. Wandering away, I think. There's a school of agriculture not far from my house, and I would literally just wander down there and smell the smells and look at the cows.
Mm-hmm.
But then for a while I was in England being a musician, and I was put up as a guest at some working farms, and I think that that's where it really took hold for me, that I just loved that. I just loved it.
Now, at this point in your life, there is kind of a crisis going on, but yet it's not a crisis somehow. I mean, I think you describe it as a crisis of a kind of a crisis of faith, but yet you're not unhappy and you're wandering toward a door that you're going to open and go through. Maybe you would share with us how you were negotiating this wandering.
Well, quietly, I think, quietly. I was feeling, as I do from time to time, although certainly not consistently, I was feeling a loss of faith around my teaching of English. It was just suddenly seeming to me very peripheral. Curiously enough, because Quakerism stands so much in individual experience and truthfulness, I was really feeling a very odd sort of disjunction between teaching the dramas of fiction, you know, and feeling, oh my goodness, you know, it would be better if people just spoke from their own experience and didn't make such a fuss. And so I was feeling a little oddly embarrassed, you know, standing there defending Oedipus and so on. And it was just a little disquiet gnawing at my soul.
You write in an essay, before you can follow your heart's desire, you have to examine your heart closely. It's a subtle instrument of inquiry, the examined heart.
Mm-hmm.
How do you begin to examine the heart?
Well, you know, what I'm saying there sounds like a metaphor, but I don't know what we would call that space that I'm mm-hmm. referring to there is the heart. But I know that there is room there that we don't always go into, and that school doesn't necessarily teach us to go into. You know, we're taught to be very analytical and rational, at least I was. And I love that rational, analytical world.
Mm-hmm.
But there is another place we can go also. And learning to live by the heart as well as by the mind, because I am one who believes in both, you have to give space to it. And very little in our lives teaches us to give space to it. So I think to develop the heart as an instrument of inquiry, we have to give it a little bit of time every day, you know, whether that's a meditation space or a prayer space, or just, you know, one of my friends was saying, hanging out in the garden. You know, there are places we give so little time to that. And when we give even a little time, it's as though it rushes in you know, like a love that we've denied. You know, give it a little opening and it goes whoosh. And all of a sudden, there it is, filling the room. And you have to deal with it. It becomes a very big thing.
Yeah. You were able to take time out to go to a monastery in France, a Buddhist monastery in France.
Mm-hmm.
And there you certainly had, you came up against an instruction to do just what you're talking about, to examine your life. Maybe you would tell us a story or two of your time at that monastery in France.
Well, I was at Plum Village, Thich Nhat Hanh's monastery, in roughly south of France. And it was a day like today. I hope it's there that way. Where you are, just beautiful and sunny and blue. Most of the time I was there, just this extraordinary opening of calm and beautiful, soft weather. And there was I in the middle of it, kicking and screaming and crabby. Because I am just not a person who does hunger, for example, very well. And it was my first real immersion in a true Southeast Asian diet of mostly tofu and greens. And I was rampaging with hunger all the time and cross with everybody I had to deal with, having flashbacks to the novitiate, much as I loved it, and the horrors of having to live, you know, literally mat by mat with other people, you know, none of whom you particularly kept the same rules as. So I was a very unhappy camper a lot of the time.
Hmm.
Very resistant, which I often am, because I just hate phony spirituality. You know, I just didn't want to be converted to anything. So I was very, very resistant. But the place, you know, gentled me down. I think the practice, just the simple practice, was extraordinary. I learned, the most important thing I think I learned was that meditation doesn't take place in the closet or, you know, on the zafu, but rather it's carried into the world. That's something that Thich Nhat Hanh is very, very good at teaching, because his own context was the Vietnam War. So he is out there in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And also just having, or just being with, you know, there are people that are very holy in the world. I've met rather few, but he's certainly one. And very, very holy people kind of radiate something that you can't help but get, no matter what a crabby old nasty person you are.
What's a zafu?
Oh, a zafu, you know, is a little pillow you sit on to meditate.
Okay. What does it mean to practice?
What does it mean to practice? Well, it's a beautiful concept in Buddhism because it doesn't involve believing or signing on to an orthodoxy so much as, or at all, but rather signing on to the discipline of a daily practice. And the practice is simply, and Kirsty, you find this in Christianity, you find it in Islam, you find it in Judaism. Simple attention. And, of course, I think you're all familiar enough with Buddhism to know that there's this sort of tradition of sitting very still. In Zen, you sit very long, but in the Mahayana tradition, you don't sit very long. And just being attentive, you know, to what? To your breath as a way of anchoring yourself, or to a mantra if you're practicing in a mantra tradition, or to a prayer if you're practicing in the Christian tradition. But just really, again, to return to that idea of allowing space.
Mm. And you, as an owly American, had to practice anger. Tell us about that.
Well, I think that when you sit in that place, and a person who's spoken very wisely about this is the Cistercian Thomas Keating, Father Thomas Keating, who writes about centering prayer in the Christian tradition, mm-hmm. and he is also a psychiatrist as well as a long-time contemplative. He writes about how when you sit, everything comes up in your life. You know, if your root emotion is anger, anger comes up. If your root emotion is grief, grief comes up. And my experience of that is that you become a kind of flute for whatever is coming through you. That's kind of a musical image. You just let it go through the instrument. And after you have sat with it, the Buddhists also talk about taking tea with your demons.
Mm-hmm.
They become very tame. And it flows out of you. So I think that I needed to be very angry for a while. I laugh as I think about what a big dummy I was. But I haven't been so angry since. So I think a lot of it just flowed out.
Let's talk with a listener who's waiting to talk with us on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hello. I heard you mention Thich Nhat Hanh.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that he was involved in a peace movement in Vietnam, trying to kind of be somehow bring together the Viet Cong and the U.S. I'm not quite sure he was involved in the Paris peace talks. But as a person who does meditation, how do you think that, you know, from your experience, we might best react to the political situation now and the bombing on September 11th? I mean, suddenly we believe that our life has changed, or we feel less secure,
mm-hmm.
or we're concerned about how we should react, whether we should take revenge, whether we should seek justice, whether we should go to war, you know, what kind of war it should be. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I have so many, so I hope you'll stay on and talk to me so I don't just launch, launch myself. You know, one thing that comes to me right away is that I don't know how people can survive time like this without a meditation practice. It's as though a meditation practice kind of eats the trouble of the day, literally, just eats it for dinner. And, you know, you can sit with it. I don't know how we can bear the suffering of other people without a deep prayer or contemplative practice. So I think it's extremely helpful.
I have a notion of what you mean by sit with it, but could you elaborate on that?
Well, what I find myself doing is I do a lot of the Buddhist practice called metta meditation, which you may know, loving-kindness meditation.
Yeah, I've heard of that, but I'm not real familiar.
Okay. Which is just a way of sending to yourself, which is very, very important because, you know, some activists can forget to send loving-kindness to themselves, to those you love, to those you are at enmity with, to offer, you know, Christians would call it prayer for them, you know, for their health and the security of their lives, for the peace of their soul. Okay, so I find myself doing that meditation a lot. That's a way of sitting with it. I find myself drawing into myself, you know, these images and this terrible suffering and just holding it in love and then breathing it out with a kind of love and peace. I think that that's something we can do.
So you're developing the love within you despite some of the horrible stuff outside in the world and trying to somehow send the love energy out? Or
breathing love to it. And, you know, I mean, it feels terrible to us because we're suffering so horribly. But, you know, I've been feeling also, you know, for years, just extraordinary, especially since I studied with Thich Nhat Hanh, the suffering of first the Southeast Asian people, you know, I just really began to feel that in my bones. And that isn't a grim thing for me, because you breathe it in and you breathe it out. It isn't as though you hold on to it and get bummed. That's not what I'm saying at all.
Suffering. Okay.
It's a way of being with it, you know, being with it as though you'd hold the child in your arms,
mm-hmm.
not being with it in a, you know, getting down into the muck and feeling awful. That's not a good idea at all. Then, in just on a very practical level, I think that when we have a habit and teach others a habit of allowing a little space, you know, in our day where we can do something, you know, a random act of rationality, as I saw a bumper sticker, commit random acts of rationality. If you take some time, you know, just, I mean, not everybody who's going to hear this is going to run out and start meditating, but when you go out in the morning and pick up your paper and you see you know, the last stars, give them a minute. You know, breathe in. Just very, I try to set up, you know, moments in my day when I'm certainly going to be there. Thich Nhat Hanh used to talk about brushing his teeth. He always had to do it. That was a moment to remember. And just allow a space for that vengeful and, you know, non-productive feelings to slip away. We do a lot of nasty things when we're just flying off the cuff, as we all know. Mm-hmm. So it's a breathing space.
I wanted to ask you about another issue, and that's the question of compassion. Actually, I felt that someone on another program might have been responding to something that I said on an earlier program about compassion. And I really actually wasn't talking about having compassion for these bombers. I was talking about having compassion in general for people who may have suffered throughout the world. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't making an exact cause and effect relationship or in any way justifying what happened. But, I mean, we know that there has been a lot of suffering in Iraq, for example. But is it possible to have compassion and yet seek justice at the same time?
Oh, my goodness, what a profound question. I wish that Thich Nhat Hanh were here to answer it. Well, you know, I think that justice is a step of mercy. You can't just be merciful, you know, as a teacher, for example, or people will not rise to their best efforts. They will not learn. They will not, you know, pull themselves together. So you, the possibility of justice, the invocation of justice, has to be, you know, on the pathway to mercy. What you do after justice is a whole different thing. But I'm not sure they're so much compatible as that one follows the other. But if you only have mercy, unless you are a very holy bodhisattva or holy person, I'm thinking through this as I speak because perhaps it's possible to just have mercy, to just be full of it. But I am not quite capable of doing that. And if I try to exercise it with other people, sometimes they fall back from
a
certain
standard. Maybe it's a good thing to have. One may have compassion, like a mother or a father, but that doesn't mean that one doesn't have standards or require, you know, I mean, in this particular case, I think we must have justice. I'm not quite sure how we're going to attain that, but I have no question in my mind. But I'm very concerned about people wanting revenge or thinking that revenge and justice are the same thing.
Mm-hmm. No, they're not the same thing. That I do know. I'm sure about that.
Okay, I want to jump in here because we've got another caller waiting, and I want to go to someone else and talk with them this afternoon. I want to thank our first caller this afternoon, and next we're going to go to a caller in Champaign on line two. Good afternoon.
Hi, and I am very thankful to hear words of truth spoken openly on the radio. This is wonderful. I think for myself, as someone who has perhaps been exposed to Buddhism from an early age but had a hard time actually practicing it, that first of all, if you could talk about a concept, I'm also curious to hear how maybe it cross-correlates with Christianity, because so often, unfortunately, Christianity is associated with dialectic thinking, you know,
mm-hmm.
dividing things. If you could talk about concepts like the interconnectedness of being, because I think from the viewpoint of maybe Buddhism, that it is important to ask, how are we connected to people? You know, how are events connected? When you were talking about how, you know, we just sit and meditate, it makes me think of a dojo I was in where they quoted Oh Sensei, the teacher and founder of Aikido, who just said, everything is connected. And I think that's a very profound truth that at least I, as an American, have struggled with. So I'm curious about your thoughts about that.
Mm-hmm. I think that although Christianity is often given to dialectical thinking, there is a deep vein in Catholicism or in Christianity, but perhaps especially in Catholicism, and that's all I know, of being in that open, contemplative, connected space. You know, so that's certainly a place where Buddhism and Christianity touch. Connection, the idea that we are all connected used to be one of those things that you'd sort of sign on to, like the creed for me. You know, like, okay, I believe in the connectedness of all beings. And I didn't have much evidence for it. But again, when you allow yourself to open up to that, to the possibility, suddenly things begin to rush at you. And I think thing after thing piles up to remind you or to tell you maybe for the first time how not a metaphor that is, but a reality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and different people will observe it differently. I know scientists who see that as a scientific premise and mystics who see it as a mystical premise and gardeners who know about roots under the ground. But I know that when, you know, when I heard about the World Trade Center, you know, my first thought was, oh, that could be my children. And my second thought was, those are my children. Because so profound is that sense of connection for me.
Well, and I was thinking about the justice and mercy issue, which is certainly a very, it's a strong construct, perhaps, in human beings. We have so many tales of justice and so many myths of justice. And but I certainly know when I've been thinking about the pain and suffering and our response, I try to remember, you know, the five precepts that the Buddha taught. That, and the first is, you know, kind of one of these harm ye none, you know, just general principles that you will harm none.
Mm-hmm.
And so it transforms the way I think we can think about justice if mm-hmm. we think perhaps about healing,
mm-hmm.
because I work in domestic violence, and I think that's a very challenging area because it's human nature to want justice, and I think, you know, maybe it's something from our childhoods that we want to push back when we feel something is pushed on us. And I think recently for me, justice, as always in spiritual matters, comes back to trying to create a space in myself for balance, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
That
mm-hmm.
that's where I find justice. I'm not sure.
Oh, that's beautifully said.
Yeah, I'm not sure we can find it outside. I just know that, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh, and thank you for pronouncing his name because I've always wondered how to pronounce it.
Usually called Thai, which just means teacher.
Oh, okay.
So that's way easier than having to roll all those consonants.
And because certainly when I've read quite a bit of his, and he wrote a play about his experiences during the Vietnam War where four dead souls are journeying on a river, and the teacher character, who I believe is female, merely talks about compassion, and that even though they were just, I can't remember, I think they were executed by Southern Vietnamese forces, that they need to have compassion
mm-hmm.
for the people who slew them. And it was truly a deep message to
mm-hmm.
me that
mm-hmm.
that is an incredibly loving goal. And so I'm just very glad to hear words of healing. And again, if you had any ideas of how maybe Western people can begin to view the connectedness, because I think so often when we do go to meditate, we wonder things like, why am I angry? And then we realize, well, maybe somebody hurt our feelings or we were, you know, harboring harmful thoughts. And that's where, you know, I tend to see the connectedness as I want to be able to say, you know, well, this moment is this, and, you know, it has nothing to do with previous moments. So
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I'm just curious what words you might have found, and I'll listen. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, one of Thich Nhat Hanh's ways of looking at that is breathing in, I know that I'm angry, for example, if that's what you are. You feel your anger. Or even if you're just walking around having fights with people, and you can do this without even being on the pillow, you can just say, breathing in, I know that I'm angry. But the second move is, breathing in, I see the deep roots of my anger. So it's a kind of educational process. And if you go through that over and over, you know, you begin to indeed see the deep roots of your anger. And then his next thought is that he said, you have to embrace your anger like a loving older sister. He said, older sister does never leave younger sister alone. So you have to hold the part of yourself that's angry and frightened until it lets go, which might take 10 minutes or might take 30 years, depending, I think. And I think that we may be doing that as a culture right now. We may be just kind of beginning to look, as Americans, at the deep roots of some of these situations. And when we can do that, we will come to some kind of compassion. We will come to some understanding.
Mary Rose O'Reilly is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of The Barn at the End of the World, The Apprenticeship of a Quaker Buddhist Shepherd. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Mary Rose O'Reilly was raised a Catholic. Today she's a Quaker and a student of Buddhism. She teaches at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota. Listeners, you're invited to join us with questions and comments in Champaign-Urbana. 333-9455 is our number. Anywhere else, toll free, 1-800-222-9455. Mary Rose, in the first essay of the book, Surrender, you tell readers, a casual dissolution of boundaries, body to body, happens when you work in the barn. With animals, it's safe and pertinent to have no edges. Is this a little bit like sitting?
Oh, yes, very much. It's very much the same thing. And I think that it's why the Benedictines, for example, have such a strong tradition of working, doing manual labor especially, while you're trying to develop your inner world. Because I love farmers, you know, and when you're farming, there are just a lot of contemplative moments if you're not sitting on top of one of those giant tractors and watching TV. You know, you just have to lean on your rake a lot because you get very worn out and just be in quiet. And when you're working with animals, it's an extraordinarily inward kind of space that you enter with them. I mean, animals don't have really good analytical skills. Many, many virtues that they do have.
It's a very physically demanding job to
Sadly.
Be a shepherd. Would you give us some idea of the demands of the job?
Oh, my goodness. Well, one of the reasons I'm not doing it right now is I've just gotten a little too arthritic, although that's starting to get better. You know, when people talk about lambs, I think they see tiny little cute things, and when we're moving lambs in production agriculture, they are 150-pound, you know, year-old wethers and so forth. We still call them lambs, and they're big, and they don't want to go where you want them to go. So there's lots of climbing on them and climbing over them. And I've seen shepherds walk across the backs of 30 sheep, you know, to get where they're going. So it is very physically demanding, and you have to flip them over a lot because you have to shear them or shear their udders when they're ready to lamb. And so it's a lot of physical work, pretty hard for a middle-aged lady. That was really one of the big challenges for me.
Yeah, and a ram can get very large.
They get very big, and one of the recurring mantras in the book is never turn your back on a buck ram.
I mean, these animals are as large as the largest football players.
Oh, yeah, they can run 300 pounds.
Yeah.
They're big guys. You got to go run, chase them, grab them, get them to go where you want them to go.
So how does one flip a sheep?
I used to be good at it. Well, actually, when I was doing it, it reminded me a lot because I went to an inner-city school of the kind of maneuvers that the girls used to learn to, you know, to trip the boys when they were grabbing your pigtails. You know, you just kind of step behind them and flip them over your leg.
Mm.
You know, kind of using, it's like an Aikido move. It can be like an Aikido move, at least, if you are wise.
How does the barn feel? Do you know what I'm saying? What does it look like? What does it smell like? What does it feel like?
Well, there are certainly barns and barns. One of the things I said in the book was that we didn't have a romantic barn. It was a big old ugly pole barn.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a reasonably clean barn, by the way, a commercial message. But it was, you know, I think it gathers the spirits of those who work there together under such pressure and at, you know, all hours of the night, and the animals moving so quietly, and always, I think, very calming to the shepherd. And I've heard so many farmers tell me this, you know, just that quietness that comes over a barn full of animals at night. At other times, curiously enough, the animals are very disturbed, and it's the shepherd that has to create that spirit of calm.
Hmm.
I find shepherds to be very lovely people. I've never met a shepherd or a cow person I didn't like, I must say, or a vet. They begin to have a way with them of calming, you know, the stirred up
mm-hmm.
animals.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us about Ben.
About Ben. Well, Ben was the guy I worked for, and he was a very young man. He was only, I think, maybe 20 when I started to work for him. He was a great big northern Minnesota farm kid who could do absolutely anything and was very, very smart. You know, just really knew what he was doing analytically and intuitively with the animals. He and I just really got on because he wanted to know a lot, you know, about this or that I might have known. He especially loved talking religion. He was came from a very small Lutheran synod that was very fundamentalist, and so he loved to talk religion all day because he wanted to know more than he had grown up with
mm-hmm.
and to challenge some of his ideas, and so we were always talking back and forth. And generous in his teaching of a 50-year-old skinny woman. Extremely generous. And just assumed I could do it, you know, because he'd never met anybody that couldn't growing up on a farm. And so he just assumed I could, so I did, mostly.
Yeah. And he was a leader, and you followed.
Oh, yes.
He was your shepherd.
I adored Ben.
Yeah. And you wanted to... not to disappoint and not to be discovered as, quote, the lamb hugger.
Yes. Yes, I had a terror of that.
Yeah. Now, did your attitudes about farming change as a result of working in the barn?
Well, I did come out a bit as a lamb hugger by the end of the book, because when I was training my own students, you know, I didn't train them like Ben did, because he was big and strong and I was little and had to trick animals first of all. And I learned, I've always been around animals all my life, and I learned long ago to talk to animals in their own language a little bit. I'm not going to go into that in great detail. But I would teach my students, you know, to make sounds with them. And so so Ben used to get a big charge out of my great big male students who would really wind up lamb hoggers in one way or another. He just thought it was funnier than heck. But if it worked, it was okay.
Yeah.
And, well, my attitudes toward farming, I've become very committed to sustainable agriculture and to small farming. I've become more understanding, however, of what production farmers are trying to do. You know, I guess I'm saying, once again, it's increased my range of understanding and compassion. Let's see. I love it. You know, I'm so hungry for it now. It's just very hard for me to be in the city.
Mm.
And I really crave the company of farmers. I find sometimes the company of academics to be a little unreal. And I just really like to hang around with farmers. And I like to work. I also find it very hard to be in a situation where I can't do a lot of physical work.
Now, what's been the reaction to your colleagues there at the University of St. Thomas to your becoming an apprentice shepherd?
I'm not sure they're especially aware of it. They ignore it pretty much, which is fine with me, as I am a rather shy person, especially around the university, and I don't know what we'd talk about. I can't say that one of them has ever mentioned it.
Oh, that's interesting.
Well, you know, we're all very busy as teachers. Yeah. It's an extraordinarily, it's busy in a different way than farming is busy. It's a rattling kind of busyness.
Yeah. Maybe you'd share with us the little story that you tell in the book about finishing up work, your work at, for the day at the barn, and then stopping on the way back to wherever you were going, your office or your home, for an espresso.
Oh, yeah, there was an espresso shop across the street. You know, these come everywhere in the world nowadays.
Across the street from the barn.
From the barn, right. Well, you know, across the street and a bunch of fields and, you know, a lot of urban sprawl. Let's see, how'd that go? Well, I just remember that I would go in there and I would be dirty. And I would be, they would be giving me looks. In fact, this was something I really enjoyed because I kind of came to understand some of the divisions in our world. There would be all these intellectuals sitting there with those little round intellectual glasses, and they would give me these looks like, and farmers feel this, you know, farmers feel that Ben would feel, for example, that the people looked at him as not an intelligent person. Mm. He gives these odd looks, and then, you know, you give the same look back, your sort of blue-collar look back, you know, that signifies the class violation.
And I'm sure if one of those academics showed up in a barn,
like hi-hat, for example.
Right, it would be sort of the same kind of situation as we size one another up by our costume.
Well, I taught a lot of vet students eventually, and so, you know, people are very different. There are people that would come from the suburbs and from lives of privilege, and you'd think, oh, goodness, you know, here comes somebody I'm not going to be able to deal with, and they would get right down to it, you know, very intelligently and thoughtfully and with an intuitive sense of how to do it. Mm. So people are different. There's a certain, well, never mind. There's a certain kind of person that you sort of, the general word in vet school is equine queens, who come in wanting to be horse vets, only talk to horses and, you know, never take off their riding chaps or whatever those things are. And they are a little uppity. But everybody else gets down pretty quick.
In the book and here during this interview, you talked about growing tired of the reading and of fiction. That's got to be pretty tough for an English professor to deal with that. And I'm wondering, are you back to books?
Am I back to books? Well, for a long time, I really began to teach nonfiction pretty regularly and seriously. I taught courses in memoir and courses in spiritual autobiography, and I'm very prejudiced towards people's stories, people's own stories, rather than made-up stories. I've never lost my love and devotion to poetry, which somehow seems more close to personal experience, although my poet friends tell me that's not true. They make it up. And I have come back really only in the last year or so to beginning to read fiction again. But it's not my favorite genre. There's just so much wonderful nonfiction to read.
Yeah. What have you been reading lately in the way of memoir that you think has been fine work?
Well, I'm a great reader of Wendell Berry. He's a person that I read over and over again. And I guess I'll tell you writers not so much that I've been reading this week as people I go back to. Another person I go back to is Thomas Merton, whom I've read since I was in high school and just read over and over and over. Just I read his journals. I read Mae Sarton. I love the journals of people, and both Sarton and Merton do this, who just publish the way they write. They don't revise it and reform it and tart it up, you know. Mm. So you get that sense of life in motion, you know, real thought in motion.
Interesting.
I love Virginia Woolf's nonfiction. I love her fiction, too, I must say.
Well, what's next? Are you working on a book, or what are you up to these days? You're not. You said your joints aren't happy with you doing that heavy sheep flipping thing.
The carrying is what really does you in. The 50-pound bales. Well, I came at the end of the book to the idea that I wanted to have a farm that would be a refuge for animals and people. And I envisioned building a hermitage where people could come and stay. And, oh, I wish I had it now because, you know, I just hear from so many people that need to be there overnight at least. I haven't been able to do that because urban sprawl has kind of pushed up the prices so much around right where I am, but I hope to do that. I hope to have that place. Ben calls it a religious petting zoo. Mary's religious petting zoo. But anyway, but my partner and I have begun to do a wild animal rehabilitation. So we take care of injured wildlife, which is a licensing program in the state of Minnesota anyway. And so you go through quite an educational process and a practical hands-on process. So we take care of small animals that you don't have to flip.
Mm. We're out of time. We've got to go. I want to say thank you very much and our best to your guy, Robin. and good luck with your dream.
Oh, thank you very much, Celeste. It was a joy to talk to you.
Mary Rose O'Reilly has been our guest this afternoon on the Afternoon Magazine. Her book, The Barn at the End of the World, The Apprenticeship of a Quaker Buddhist Shepherd, is published by Milkweed Press.